out of order on the bills so that we can accommodate a person who has another commitment. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2153. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. House Bill 2153 is, again, a Department of Human Services, the Health Division bill. It refers to the ALERT program, which we heard. House Bill 2144, that is the statewide immunization registry program. This bill is asking to modify current statutes that restrict the exchange of that immunization information. They want to change it so that the ALERT program can share immunization records with other states, local states.
Okay, with that, we'll call up Dr. Jim Lace.
Good morning, Chairman Cruz, members of the committee. Thank you. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 2153. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem. I'm also representing the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. Very briefly, we're in favor of this bill. There's a couple issues that come up when you share potentially confidential information. When you go to your doctor, you have something done, you don't necessarily want that made public to the rest of the world. Immunizations, we've separated those out and said, wait a minute, those should be openable, or if you will, not as quite as confidential. They're kept confidential in our records, and they're kept confidential in the system, but the data for these kids needs to be shared somehow. For an example, Marion County leads the state in methamphetamine busts. I didn't realize this until last week. And we generate about 200 kids or more that come into the foster care system because of these drug busts. When the cops go out and do a bust, they'll take the kids, and the kids are sort of a byproduct. They're not the main source of why they're doing the drug bust. But so these kids will come into the foster care system. They'll come into my office. We'll have no other information about them. We have a name. We can query the immunization registry and say, hey, here's the vaccine. They need something. Great, it's done. What this bill does is expand that. So if we have somebody that's in going to Washington or vice versa, we can actually share that data, and that this information is in that system. It's protected, but it's information that we think is extremely valuable. Also, this prevents kids from being vaccinated two or three or four times for the same disease. And so we don't over-immunize, and if they're under-immunized, we can try to catch them up. And our whole attempt is to make sure the kids are adequately immunized.
Any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Never dawned on me, but is there a difficulty in a doctor seeing a patient who's already been immunized, young patient who doesn't remember what he's had, he or she, and revaccinating?
Well, yes. If we have a six-month-old, it's very hard for them to recall their last immunization.
So I'm saying in terms of the titer of the vaccine, is that a problem in giving a double dose?
Well, yes. I mean, I don't know about it necessarily a problem, but it's with all the multiple vaccine schedules that we have now, it results in extra immunizations. There is always that theoretical risk that a child, if you have had a reaction or something like this, if they got the same vaccine again, may have some issues. For example, my son, a long time ago, before we had adequate immunization records, actually got two shots within a month. We had just moved from where I was doing my training program out to Portland, and there was a little screw-up in the records. Both clinics did not keep adequate records, actually. And so ended up with the same vaccine within a very short period of time. I actually had an allergic reaction to it, you know, and so didn't really need it, but that was sort of just a screw up in the system. This is aimed at making sure that we don't do that, and we've got an adequate tracking system.
Okay. Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Lisa, I had a question about the children that you see that have been pulled out of methamphetamine homes. I guess my question is, what sort of problems the kids come in with? Are you seeing any effects of the kids being in places where they manufacture these drugs?
The biggest issue is neglect. They usually come in with really bad teeth. almost like their parents have really bad teeth. And I'm not sure what it is in the environment, whether it's just inadequate care, neglect. Usually it's neglect, it's poor nutrition. Actually, there's a magnet grant that Marion County just got, $250,000, to start looking at what are the health effects on these children. And developing actually a system. Right now, there's going to be a protective caseworker that goes out with the police on these drug busts, so that instead of the kid being, oh, there's some kids there, somebody down the street can take them, sort of a thing, up, we've got somebody assigned to take care of these kids. So it's an unknown question. You'd think with all those toxic chemicals, and here the people that are going in to detoxify the lab have to wear these big, you know, suits, and these kids living in there. Like, oh my gosh, they must be terrible. But it's an unknown at this point, because nobody's been looking at these kids in a systematic manner.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Who brings the, Dr. Lee, who brings the children in?
They come in, they'll be taken in, they'll put into, you know, protective custody, and then they'll be assigned a caseworker. And the caseworker will either bring them in, or they'll be put into a foster home, and the foster mom or foster parents will bring them in at that point. And so whether it's a drug bust or some other issue, that's the system. Approximately about 80 to 90% of our kids in foster care now are being generated because of parents abusing drugs and doing something stupid, you know, crossing the legal line, and then the kids are being taken away from them.
Thank you, Dr. Lace.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Lace, sounds like a great bill to me. Do we have compacts with other states so we can get that information from the other states as well?
I'm going to let the people from the state health, well, it used to be the state health division, whatever it is. So I'm going to let them answer that question.
Thank you.
People from that state, then. Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lorraine Duncan.
Good morning. My name is Lorraine Duncan. I'm the Immunization Program Manager for the Department of Human Resources, and I was here last Friday, so I probably look very familiar testifying about House Bill 2244 about the statewide immunization registry. This is about the same statewide immunization registry, and House Bill 2153, we're asking your support. It regards, as Dr. Had mentioned earlier, that for interstate transfer of immunization records. And the reason that it's so important to us, many children live on the borders, obviously. So a good example is children who live in Columbia County often go to Longview for their health care, and then their immunization records are in the Washington registry, not in the Oregon registry. And that happens all the time along the border. Happens on the Idaho border, not so much on the California border, but Idaho and Washington.
Happens on the California border.
Right, exactly. So it's really critical, particularly for those border areas, that we see that there's a way to share those records. The other thing that obviously happens, people move from state to state, and if you don't have the ability to transfer records, it's restrictive. And so currently the way the statute is written, it says that we can share records within the state of Oregon, but we can't share them outside the state of Oregon. So the purpose of the bill is to expand it so we could do interstate transfer of records. Our plan would be, if this is approved, to start working with the state of Washington. We've already talked to them several times. They have a statewide immunization registry. It's not as well populated as the Oregon Immunization Alert, but they still have quite a few immunization records in there. The critical issue about sharing records between states is each state sets what their policies are around confidentiality and security. So if we were to share records with a different registry, we'd have to make sure that the receiving registry had as strict confidentiality and security policies as we did, so that the information would be shared the same way that it is here in Oregon. And so we've started to look at the Washington confidentiality policy and see if it works. And so far it looks very plausible. We've learned from the Washington Immunization Program that they don't need to change their statute in Washington in order to make this happen, where in Oregon we do have to change our statute. So that was encouraging. Currently, Idaho and California don't have statewide immunization registries. Idaho has a series of health districts, and they're working on putting those together and joining. So that's something that could probably happen in the future. California is working on regional registries, and they don't have a registry right now for the northern counties in California. So, I mean, those are things that will all happen, but they're probably not ready to go right now. Oregon Immunization Alert, because of the work of our alert director, Barbara Canavan, is very well respected, and they're considered one of the best registries in the United States. Currently, to the best of our knowledge, no registries are sharing records across state lines. The Center for Disease Control is really interested in a pilot to make that happen. They're really interested. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation folks are also really interested to make that happen, and have hosted a couple of meetings to see if we can get started on it. So they've asked Oregon if there's a way that we could sort of pilot this and start working on this area. So we're very excited about that possibility if this legislation gets approved. So I'd like to thank you for your support. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Lorraine. Can you explain when we have a child that obviously needs to be protected from somebody else who, what kind of protection they have? I want to go back to the confidentiality, because
sure.
I know this was an issue when this alert system was first formed, and there might be a child who, well, there are children who cannot be tracked
exactly.
by somebody else. How is their record protected?
There's in the administrative rules for this for the statewide registry, it clearly says that a parent or guardian of a child could ask for special protection of a record. And what that means is that once there's they send a letter to the alert director, which is Barbara Canavan, she would check into it, and she would make sure, talk to the who's making the request, and then those records are sealed. They're still so that those records wouldn't be available to anybody looking in the registry. Right now, I think many of you know that we have what we call authorized users, and authorized users are like doctors in the state or schools or some daycare centers that have nurses available. Those are the kind of people that can look at the registry. And the registry has a website that's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But what's on the website is very carefully guarded, and we only put part of the information in there. The information in the website has the child's name, the birth date, and the shot records. No demographics, not address, not telephone number, no way to get a hold of the child. And when we put that in the server that's on the web server, it's not in there, so there's even if somebody was trying to get into that system, hack into that system, there's not a way for them to ever get demographics. But even if they get into that system, a child that's requested their guardian or parent has requested protective care, they're not in there. It doesn't show up. They can't have access to that.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Barney Spade.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Barney Spate with Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente strongly supports this bill. We are a healthcare delivery organization that serves about 450,000 people in Oregon and Southwest Washington, and we confront this issue daily because we have patients, enrollees on the Washington side of the border in Vancouver and Longview, Kelso, and in Oregon, of course. We work very closely with Immunization Alert and use the information there to update our automated medical records on vaccinations. We have also developed a separate relationship with the Washington Registry, which Lorraine has pointed out is not quite as robust as what Oregon has, and we think this would be a great step forward for providers on both sides of state borders to be able to have as current of information about immunizations as possible. So we think this is a good bill.
Great questions. Thank you, Barney. No, I'd really like to move this bill, but Katie King didn't sign up to testify, so I just don't know. Hi, Katie. I'm going to close the public hearing on on House Bill 2153 and open a work session on House Bill 2153. Colleagues, the bill calls for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It does not need it. There is no revenue impact, so we would need to rescind that referral.
So moved.
Okay, Representative Anderson has moved House Bill 2153 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and has moved the removal of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Was that basically what you said? I thought so.
We could call Katie King up. We could invite her up to testify.
I know, but she's so shy, I think we'll just let it go. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Delta?
Aye.
Representative Morris
Sanders? Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Westman?
Aye.
Representative Chair Cruz?
Votes aye. House Bill 2153, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Colleagues, do we want this on the consent calendar, or do we want to air this before the body?
I think consent calendar would be appropriate.
Representative Tomei moves that House Bill 2153 be placed on the consent calendar. Seeing no objections, so ordered, and we will close the public or the work session on House Bill 2153. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2129. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2129 is making a couple of changes to the current statutes. It's eliminating the requirement that optometrists have consulting privileges in certain rural hospitals. Those rural hospitals have to be in rural designated areas in order to claim the rural medicine practice income tax credit. And the second change is to apply to the bill identifies the tax year beginning in 2004, but you should have a -1 amendment that is changing that to begin the tax period beginning January 1, 2003.
Where's Bill Pass when you need him?
Excuse me. Do the members all have the amendment?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Bill, do you and Wayne and Chuck all want to come together?
Chair Cruz, member of the committee, my name for the record is Wayne Schumacher. I'm the executive director of the Optometric Physicians Association. Good morning to you all, and I'm particularly pleased to be able to provide testimony on House Bill 2129. And my written testimony essentially gives you a history of what the bill is. Needless to say, the last session, this act came up for sunset review and was indeed continued. So what we're asking for, and what indeed 2129 does, is remove the requirement for optometric physicians to have hospital consulting privileges to qualify for the tax credit. Over the course of the last 5 years, almost no rural hospitals have given optometric physicians privileges. And so consequently, in our understanding, only five have qualified. And the Office of Rural Health has recently kind of redistricted or redone the boundaries for what is rural and eliminated frontier, as there were three initial grades, rural, remote, rural, and frontier. Essentially now everything's rural. Based on that redistricting, we're not quite sure, but we think that a maximum of about another 20 might potentially qualify. That's our estimate. And it's clear that this tax credit over the course of its history has allowed or incentivized a number of rural health practitioners that may have left or were considering coming in. It's incentivized them to stay or to come in. This type of bill in other states have done the same thing, North Dakota, for an example. So we think it's real critical for the health care of rural citizens. With me today is one of our optometric physicians, Dr. Chuck Wardle, who also sits on the is a representative of the Rural Health Tax Council, and he may have some additional remarks for you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and the committee members. My name is Charles Wardle. I'm an optometric physician. I am licensed in the state of Washington and the state of Oregon. I have practice locations both in Oregon and in Washington, Longview, Washington, and Clatskanie, Oregon. I started out in these hallowed halls many years ago. I was the paperboy delivery for the Capitol building back before any of you were born. I started out just down here on 13th and Court. That's where I lived in a basement apartment, and I delivered the Oregon Journal, the Oregonian, the Statesman Journal, or the Statesman, or Salem Statesman, I think we called them those days, and the Statesman Journal. Now, you're looking at each other and saying, okay, what was the Capital Journal? What was the Oregon Journal?
But those, I remember the Oregon.
Do you? Okay, great. I did my public school training here in Salem, and I graduated with a BA from Miami University, went on Pacific University, and got an optometry degree, and have moved to the town of Rainier, Oregon, which is in Columbia County. I have been privileged to be on this committee, the Rural Health Council Committee, for the last several years representing the Oregon optometric profession. And it has come to our attention many times that some of my colleagues that practice in rural communities are unable to get these tax credits that were put together by the legislature as an incentive to keep practitioners in our rural community, because of this hospital privilege problem. And this is what we would like to see removed. Several optometrists have sent me notices or phone calls saying that I have tried to apply for privileges through my local hospital and I get through certain mechanisms of the credentialing process and then I am denied. And so therefore, once they are denied based on the fact that they have somebody else in that area that can service some of their needs, we find that they do not get the tax credit. Now, my understanding is the same as Wayne's, that we have only five optometrists that qualify or have qualified for this. There might be more, but that was my understanding. And my understanding in the future that there would probably be a maximum of 20. There could be only 12 that would qualify. But the problem that we see that needs to be eliminated is this fact of hospital consulting privileges should be eliminated so they can then have a clear sailing to get the tax credit this so much deserved. Since I graduated in 1969 from the College of Optometry at Pacific, the scope of practice of optometry has changed quite a bit, and many times we are the entry level into the eye care profession. And many of us reside in communities that have no physicians. If any of you are familiar with Columbia County, you can almost go from St. Helens to Astoria and not see anybody shingle hanging out. That happens in the same of rural eastern Oregon. Central Oregon is now becoming a little bit more popularized, but when I grew up, actually, Salem was rural. It was 40,000 people, and we thought it would never move. In fact, one gentleman spoke and said that one day there would be a continuation between Portland and Salem, and it would be one city. However, forgot about Eisenhower coming in and putting an interstate highway down here, and so that changed all the linkage. So now we have basically the I-5 corridor that is doesn't qualify for this, but we move outside this I-5 corridor, which is the eastern and some of the central Oregon, southern Oregon, that this is where these individuals would benefit from such credit. Can I answer any questions?
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have a question for Wayne. Wayne, what does it take for an optometrist to receive consulting privileges from a hospital?
They will usually contact the administrator. There's an application and a credentialing form. Those are filled out, submitted back to the administrator. Typically, there's a credentials review committee within the hospital. They will review that and then determine based on their rules and policies, whether it's individual will be granted privileges or not. Now, theoretically, that's the technical. Obviously, there's some other issues regards with maybe a physician, a medical physician doesn't want an optometrist as a privileged individual, but they still use them in an advisory capacity at some point, but don't want them on the hospital rolls. There may be reasons for that, I don't know, but our experience has been that, I think I can only think of two or three optometrists that have even gotten these privileges.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll send it over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Elaine, again, in rural Oregon or eastern Oregon, some of the more isolated areas, isn't it true that if you didn't have an optometrist to go, you might have to go 200 miles or something to see an eye doc?
Yes, Representative Barker, that is indeed true. In fact, there are several places in Oregon where that's the case, and in fact, optometry in eastern Oregon tends to be the only eye care practitioner in that whole area. So.
And follow up on that. And so that they can handle minor emergencies. A farm worker gets a splinter of steel in his eye or something, they'd be able to treat him, and if it needed more, then to send him on, but give that important early aid.
Sure, Cruz, Representative Barker. Indeed, that's true. And thanks to the legislature last session, now we can also provide non-topical medications for infection, et cetera, so systemically treat. So, yes, indeed, the role is even expanded.
Thank you.
Bill. Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm retained by the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. And I just wanted to indicate that we have talked, this bill does have a subsequent re-referral to the Revenue Committee, and I did talk to the chair of the committee just to find out what the policy was going to be on tax credits because of the budget implications this time around, and he indicated that they are building a matrix of all the different tax credits. We'll be looking at those that are up for review this time around. We'll be looking at, obviously, in terms of the budget, what kinds of tax credits may or may not be of continuing benefit in terms of looking at trying to help with the budget situation. We, under the information we had, the revenue implications were pretty modest, and those were going to be included in that matrix, but because of the health-related kind of policy issues would be something that would be presumably not in the $10, $20 million kind of tax credits that they're going to really scrutinize. There is some additional information that you'll be receiving from the Office of Rural Health. Those numbers are significantly larger than what we're aware of in terms of number of optometric physicians that could be eligible for the tax credit if the hospital privilege restrictions were removed. And I guess our suggestion would be to, if the committee's in support of the notion of trying to make provide an opportunity for optometric physicians to apply for this credit, to send the bill to revenue and have the revenue department do a projection or revenue estimate, because we really don't know to the extent of how many additional optometric physicians are included in this rural category. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Karen Scott.
Mr. and Ms. Vice Chair and members of the committee, let me begin by introducing myself and my colleague and giving you a brief history of the tax credit program. I'm Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health at Oregon Health and Science University, and this is Scott Ekblad, who is our deputy director, and he's joining me today to answer any questions you may have on recruitment and retention of practitioners, because the tax credit has been our most powerful recruitment and retention tool. It was originally passed in 1989 in Senate Bill 438, which was an omnibus rural health bill, to attract rural, to attract practitioners to rural communities and provide basic health services. The credit was initially limited to physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. In 1988, Oregon was facing a real crisis in rural, in health care in rural areas. In only 2 years, between 86 and 88, nearly a quarter of the physicians in eastern Oregon had left their practices. And these were not physicians who were retiring. These were young physicians who were leaving rural Oregon to practice somewhere else. So the legislature passed this law in 1989 that offered a unique incentive to rural practitioners, and we were the only state that offered this incentive, and we remain the only state that offer it in exactly this form. A personal state income tax credit of up to $5,000 per year for a maximum of 10 years. And in the last legislative session, that maximum of 10 years was removed, so now it is a lifetime credit for a rural practitioner. Over the years, the legislature has added other practitioners to this benefit. Certified registered nurse anesthetists, or CRNAs, have been added, podiatrists, dentists, and optometrists to the list of eligible practitioners. Varying criteria apply to each group, but the common denominator for all is that 60% or more of their practice needs to be in a qualifying rural area. Oh, I've got... Let me get this to the... Attached to my testimony, I've got a map of the rural areas of the state. Physicians, podiatrists, optometrists, and CRNAs must generally be associated with a Type B or a Type A rural hospital or an exceptional Type C rural hospital, and a few exceptions do apply. Dentists must meet additional requirements relating to reimbursement, and the legislature originally limited the total numbers of certified optometrists to only 5. That was the first year. Last tax year, we actually gave the credit to 19 optometrists. As of the 2001 tax year, there were 1,516 practitioners claiming the credit. And by profession, they break down as 1,014 physicians, 274 nurse practitioners, 82 physician assistants, 50 dentists, 58 CRNAs, 19 podiatrists, and 19 optometrists. The numbers of participating physicians in this program have more than doubled since 1990, which was the first eligible tax year, and the numbers of nurse practitioners have increased fourfold. By any measure, this program has been an outstanding success, and that is the conclusion reached by the Department of Revenue in its biennial required report that evaluates all the tax credits in the state. The bill you're considering today would change the eligibility criteria for optometrists who participate in this program. Currently, the statute requires that optometrists have consulting privileges in a Type A, Type B, or eligible Type C rural hospital, unless they are practicing in a frontier county. Now, the frontier counties are shaded on the map that you have before you. There are 10 of them in Oregon. They have 6 or fewer people per square mile. And they include Baker, Gillum, Grant, Harney, Lake, Malheur, Morrow, Sherman, Wallowa, and Wheeler counties. There are currently 12 optometrists practicing in these counties. And the other 7 who have the tax credit have obtained consulting privileges at hospitals in Gold Beach, Madras, Florence, Cottage Grove, and Tillamook. If the section requiring hospital privileges were removed, the only criteria for eligibility would be practice in a rural community. And looking at the January 2003 licensure data, this would allow at least 98 additional optometrists to qualify. The Rural Health Coordinating Council, on whom Dr. Wardle serves and has been a very good member for many years, is our governor-appointed advisory group, and they reviewed this proposal last month and considered it very carefully. Their recommendation was that the term consulting be removed from the statute, but that the required hospital relationship be maintained. So that is the position that I'm relaying to the committee. The term consulting seems to have been the problematic issue for the optometrists. Right after the optometrists were allowed to participate in the program, I wrote a letter to all of the rural hospitals urging them to allow the optometrists to become members of their medical staff so that they could obtain the credit. The problem is that most hospital medical staff bylaws don't use the term consulting any longer. It's become an archaic term. They have active medical staff privileges, they have courtesy privileges, and they have what they call allied health practitioner privileges. And consulting privileges generally are not a category in their bylaws, and that seems to have been the stumbling block for the optometrists getting hospital privileges. I think if we remove the term consulting, they can be admitted as allied health practitioners or as courtesy staff, and we would not recommend that that be specified, that it would just say hospital staff privileges and not specify what type.
Karen, how are those two categories defined? Allied and well, I mean, there's three categories. One clearly, the first category, clearly, you're part of the hospital. The other two, you're just kind of associated with it. How are those defined, and how easy of a hurdle is it to get over?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the active medical staff generally consists of physicians. It may also consist of nurse practitioner and physician assistants, but it's a category that requires attendance at weekly meetings.
Right.
It requires that they take rotation and be on call. You know, there are some responsibilities involved. Courtesy staff would be for someone who visits generally from another community, like a specialist who might come in once a month, or, you know, just to come in a brief period. And the allied health would be the podiatrists, the optometrists, the dentists, and other non-MD or DO types of practitioners. They would not then be required to attend the weekly meetings and have all the responsibilities of active medical staff.
Okay, for a hospital to have somebody in that allied category, what obligations does that put on them, if any?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wish I could answer that in exact detail for you, but I'm not sure. I think they have to carry malpractice insurance. That's generally a requirement of any medical staff membership.
Joe, do you have an answer to that? Or? Okay.
And I think that would vary by hospital. You know, each hospital has its own unique set of bylaws, but there's probably some kind of border plate that would apply. I'm not real sure. So I would add just one thing before I finish, and that is, in considering whether to make this criteria more liberal for any practitioner, not just optometrists, I'd like to keep in mind that the law was passed in response to proven shortages of physicians in 1989. And that the law is intended not necessarily for the benefit of individual practitioners, but for the benefit of rural communities who are seeking necessary health care. I'm certainly not opposed to optometrists obtaining this tax credit, but I do urge you to take into account the possible revenue impact and its significance in a time of scarce resources. And I'd be happy to answer any additional questions for you, and Scott could also answer questions for you.
Questions? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Bill, come back up. Yeah, I don't know, Wayne or whoever, but since you're paid to do this. Okay, what?
Good tie back up.
That is a nice tie, isn't it?
Yeah, but the black and white tie, that's better.
Yeah, that's a cool tie, too. And these other classifications, what's your reaction to? I mean, if we're dealing with archaic terminology here, I'm a little bit concerned from the perspective that if indeed we are going from a potential hit on a tax credit of $100,000 to $400,000, that may be problematic. And I don't know the extent of this universe clearly, but you know, Karen mentioned the fact that we could change the definition of the relationship with the hospital to something that may be more amenable? Comments?
Representative Cruz, member of the committee, again, Wayne Schumacher. Over the course of the last 6 years, due to an interest in our profession, we have made applications, our members have made applications to get privileges, whatever those might be, from a number of hospitals, and consistently been turned down, predominantly because of political issues. I will indicate to you, however, that we are aware of it, a number of practitioners, particularly in the Burns area and particularly in the John Day area, where practitioners have had to limit their amount of time there due to financial reasons. They needed to practice in a more urban setting, and they're splitting their time. So the care is being limited, access is being limited. And in particular, an issue in Burns, where a 75-year-old practitioner was trying to sell his practice for over four and a half years, could not get anybody to come in, and we finally did entice somebody. One of the reasons that practitioner came in was his understanding that he might be able to get some assistance. So to address that issue of, is there a need? There is definitely a need. And again, optometry is the primary practitioner, eye care practitioner in those rural areas. I was a little verbose on that answer, but that's our understanding, is that it's going to be extremely difficult to get any kind of hospital privileges if this restriction's not removed. Did that answer your question, sir?
Well, I guess when you look at what's in the law, it says they have to have consulting privileges, and that's certainly a different, that's a
specific.
That's a different relationship than visiting privileges or something like that. I mean, clearly, so I'm wondering if we're changing this universe, if there is going to be a different dynamic here. Part of my concern here, committee, is I'm not necessarily opposed to moving this. I just want to move it the right way in a defined universe so that we're giving the Revenue Committee a more or less finished product, and they're not going to have to vet all these things, and I'm not sure we're there yet. So, I mean, if we're talking about a difference, the numbers are range from 98 to 20, that's a significant range here, I think, and I just don't know that I have comfort with those numbers yet. So,
is that a Revenue Committee decision? I mean, should we do the policy piece, refer it to revenue? It's going to have to go there anyway. I mean, that they can put it into the big universe of.
They can put it in there. I guess if we're changing a relationship here, though, should we change
the policy?
Should we make sure that? I mean, my question I'm still asking myself, committee, is: do we eliminate the relationship or modify it? And I'm, you know, between Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I guess my question all along has been: what benefit would it be for an optometrist to have privileges? Seems to me that it's just in order to get this tech credit that the physicians, the ophthalmologists, don't necessarily call the optometrist into the hospital to deal with a patient. All of your equipment is in your office. It's much more convenient to be working in the office.
Absolutely.
While you can bring a dental chair in and do some services for dentistry, it would seem to me that optometry is not a needed service in the. Not, I don't mean it that it's not needed, but that it's more effective for you to work outside the office. So therefore, I don't see that the requirement that they be on the staff of the hospital is important in any way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think you've hit the nail right on the head. The fact is that if there's an eye injury and that individual actually does make it into a rural health hospital, which in a lot of cases they don't, the first place they impact or encounter is actually in the optometric physician's office. But the fact is that the equipment is there, and oftentimes, and I defer to our optometrist, Dr. Wardle, to verify this, but frankly, usually that's going to have to go back to their office for specific equipment. The fact would be that unless we remove the hospital privilege requirement, we actually haven't moved, I don't think, the goalpost at all. And it would seem to me that that if we don't remove that, all we've done is change the wording, and we may be back next session saying, see, it didn't work. We're willing to say, listen, let's find out what this financial impact is in Revenue Committee, and so essentially, I guess, hoping that we'd move it with the one modification as far as the effective for year, the one amendment, and let them deal with it as a whole issue.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. What I'm wondering, and I think this is what the chair was trying to get at, we remove it for you, then are there other medical professions that then will be able to take advantage of the credit? And I don't know enough about the providers who might be eligible, but let's just throw out, you know, physical therapists or some other entity that would then be able to get the excessive credit because we're eliminating the consulting privileges. That's
to Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. The changing of this language, I don't think affects any other provider either currently on the credit or in the statute, or potentially could come on. I mean, they would have to come in based on the merit, the need. I guess you'd have to prove that physical therapists were a primary practitioner out there and really in need of this kind of thing. I think that's on the merit of that particular profession. This change, in my humble opinion, does not change the dynamics of who's eligible for what other than the optometrist.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm totally confused. So this the only time in this whole bill that an optometrist is mentioned is in Section 1, Number 4. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this would take out any mention of optometrists, correct?
It takes them out. All this does, they're still eligible for the tax credit. All this does is remove this qualification for eligibility.
But is it mentioned anywhere else?
Section 1.
Okay, I see it.
Line 9.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
Good. Okay, we've currently got, I guess, 12 optometrists that are operating in that are receiving this tax credit in Frontier counties. I'm assuming that's correct, because if there are seven that have qualified under this and the total number is 14, that's what my math gives me. I'm assuming that those 12 are doing a fine job. My question is, if indeed there are an additional 98 optometrists who are already practicing in the rural part that will be... in other words, I guess what I'm looking at is when you look at what we've defined as rural, Roseburg isn't, Coos Bay isn't, you know, some, not huge towns, but a fairly substantial... that I think are being served now. I guess the whole purpose of this was to entice people to come into rural areas, and are we offering something to people that are already there for other reasons, and is that really the intent of the credit? See what I'm saying?
Mr. Chair, I think the purpose of the tax credit was both to entice and retain.
Retain, right.
And it is much more in these increasingly tough economic times, the cost of maintaining practices is much more difficult. So part of our problem is the retention issue, as well as the situation cited earlier about trying to sell a practice to induce somebody new to come in, but it's retention, and it's getting more and more difficult to maintain an eye care center in smaller rural areas.
Okay. Questions?
Yes.
Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess it's more of an observation than a question. I hear and respect Representative Monis Anderson's concern about sort of opening up the floodgates to additional providers receiving the tax credit, but I sort of feel like it's an issue of improving access in all the health fields in rural Oregon, and I see this bill as doing that, and I think anything we can do to protect rural Oregonians' access to health care is an important thing. So I think it's a policy issue. I feel comfortable with this bill, and I think the revenue issue should be ironed out in revenue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2129. I'm going to open the work session.
Mr. Chair, your
Representative Thomas.
Your concern, as I understand it, is that you're opening up.
Yeah, and I think my concern, number one concern is I want to create as much access in the rural parts of the state to appropriate health care as we possibly can. That's the purpose of the program. I just want to make, I just want to fully understand implications, but I think one of the things I'm looking at right now is the numbers, and that's clearly the venue of the Revenue Committee to decide on numbers. So Representative Westland, I think, was right. If we're talking policy, there is a policy issue here. The reason for the subsequent referral here is that it's not in our purview to deal with revenue in this committee. Mm-hmm. So. From that perspective, I think we'll let them, I'm prepared to let them fight this battle in the Revenue Committee as far as how they figure out the numbers personally. So,
could I move first to the amendment, please?
Yes.
Proposed amendment to House Bill 2129.
Representative Tomei moves the amendment to House Bill 2129, which basically. On line 30 of the bill changes 2004 to 2003.
Correct.
Pardon me?
We need the bill moved first?
No. You need to move all the amendments before you move the bill. Because once you've moved it, you can't amend it. You don't have it anymore. So are there any objections to that amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair, I move we send House Bill 2129 to revenue with the DuPass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2129 as amended to the Committee on Revenue with a DuPass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Monis Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I am not opposed to having optometrists receive this tax credit. But I will be a no vote just because in these economic times, I know revenue is supposed to determine this, but I can't in good conscience have a yes and provide a $5,000 tax credit. So if this was 4 years ago, I would have been a yes. But at least in these economic times, I will be a no.
You wouldn't have been a yes 2 years ago? We were having a good time 2 years ago.
I might have been 2 years ago.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking during the discussion that that this was predominantly a recruitment item and that maybe we could put a limit which might satisfy Representative Monis Anderson that, say, 5 years or 10 years until a person is in the community, functioning well, their practice is built. But I really do see, especially in the more rural areas, I don't think it's necessary once a person has their practice built in Grants Pass or in Klamath Falls or in Pendleton or cities of that size that they might necessarily need it. But I think it's a good issue to keep people, just as we're trying not only to recruit businesses to the area, but we're trying to embellish the businesses that are here and make sure they do well. I think this is a good bill, and I will vote for it.
Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just adding on to Representative Anderson's comments, it is a good recruitment tool, and if we are able to bring optometric physicians in from other states, we will be adding to our tax rolls on top of that. So I'm supportive of this bill.
Anybody else?
Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 No.
Cruz votes aye. House Bill 2129, having received the constitutionally required majority, is passed and referred to the Committee on Revenue. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2129 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2159. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, 2159 is a housekeeping bill brought forward by the Insurance Pool Governing Board. It is requesting that authority to administer the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, otherwise known as FEOP, that they receive the authority to determine when to contract with third-party administrators, and the department is here to explain the details of that.
Rocky, come on up. God, I haven't seen you since yesterday.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Pool Governing Board and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And I assure you that I am not here for 4 days, 2 hours each of those days on this bill. Mr. Chair, would you like me just to go through I provided you with some written testimony. I won't read each line. Let me just give you kind of an overview. There are really two sections to 2159. The first is really a technical adjustment where we want to change the word from adult to eligible individual. Throughout our statute, we use the word eligible individual except for one little place. And if you just look at that statute, it creates confusion if you don't read all the rest. So we just want to get consistency for our statutes. The other one is a little bit more substantive, and it relates to a clause in our statute that requires us to use a third-party administrator, which we refer to as TPA, to administer the program. And just some real quick history. In 1998, when we implemented the program, ODS Health Services, Oregon Dental Services, had a subsidiary, Best Choice Administrators, who bid on the administration of the FEOP program and was selected by the board to administer FEOP initially. Now, you have to remember, when we first came out the door, we thought we were going to have 15,000 people, later cut to 7, then to 5, then to 4, because it was general fund dollars only. And after about a year or so of operation, because of all the different expectations and changes to the program, both from a program standpoint as we learned how to administer it, but also because of the legislature and the governor and how much money they allotted to it, ODS lost a great deal of money. I think it was like $300,000 just in the first year, because they had bid expecting what the law said, which was 15,000, but we could only ended up serving, I think, about 6,300. We tried and we worked with them very collaboratively to find ways to cut costs, and finally, given the environment that continued to change, they decided in the year 2000 to exit the contract. We had an exit clause that they could do, and they worked with us for over a six-month period as we transitioned to the program to the state. We did that really kind of as an emergency because our statute required a third-party administrator, but after talking to all the other third-party administrators in the state, they all kind of said, not now, not when you're in the kind of changes and fluxes that we're going through because of the budget and the federal waivers that we were going to ask for to expand the program. All this does is change from shall to may, and I'll talk about it in a little bit. Does not preclude that once we get some stabilization in this program that we might not relook at that issue, either for all or parts of the administration of the FEOP program. So that's kind of a summary of this.
Rocky, there's no fiscal impact to this bill. We have not got a statement yet from LFO, but I've searched the bill and I can't find one. So,
Mr. Chair, we have submitted a fiscal impact, and I think it's on its way, and it is zero.
Okay. The reason I bring that up, committee, is because it has a referral to Ways and Means, and which I would propose that we rescind because it doesn't need to go there. Are there any questions? You have the luxury of having a committee that's sat in with the audit committee through most of this stuff, so our learning curve is not very steep here. So thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2159 and open work session on House Bill 2159.
Are we sending this to the
floor? Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2159 to the floor.
First, you're going to move to rescind the subsequent referral.
The subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Representative Mona Sanderson moves to rescind the subsequent referral on House Bill to Ways and Means on House Bill 2159. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered now.
Now I can refer it to the floor of the House with a 2159 with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Mona Sanderson moves House Bill 2159 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative
Belcher.
Aye.
Representative
Sanderson.
Aye.
Representative
Westman.
Excused.
Chair Cruz.
Cruz votes aye. I would entertain a motion to put this on the consent calendar.
So moved.
Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. House Bill 2159 is actually not sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It is put on the consent calendar. And I will close a work session on House Bill 2159 and open work session on House Bill 20... Excuse me. Public hearing. Get ahead of myself all the time. 2160, and I'm assuming, Rocky, you're coming back up.
Also, Mr. Chair, I would like on 2160, we do have amendments submitted to legislative council that we have not received them back due to the filing time that I turned them into them. My fault. I apologize. But they are coming.
That's okay, because I think we have another one of your bills somewhere in the pipeline, don't we?
2189?
Yeah. And then sent back here, I think. So
okay.
we'll get it eventually. So please go ahead, Rocky.
Okay. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. House Bill 2160 does one primary thing, not counting the amendment here. House Bill 2519 passed last session, requiring us to expand FEOP really into the group market. One of the former statutes of FEOP said that we were not allowed to subsidize dental-only plans. So an employer had a medical plan or a dental plan, and basically the statute said we couldn't subsidize the dental. One of the things, as we have found as we have started marketing this program, is many employers require that you take both. You can't just take the medical and not take the dental. So what House Bill 2160 does is basically say if both the dental and medical are required in terms of enrollment, if you're going to take one, you take both, then we want to make sure that we have the ability to subsidize that individual so they don't have to say no because I can't afford the extra $70 a month. And a good example of this is Kinko's down here. Minimum wage employees, they charge only $17 a month for an employee's premium, share of the premium. And that covers medical and dental. But the employee dependence is voluntary. To enroll in that voluntary medical plan, you have to take the dental, which is an additional $50 a month. We want to have the ability to go in and subsidize so we can get the spouse and the children into those plans, not just the employees. So 2160 basically gives us the ability, only in the group market, and only when it's required by the employer that you enroll in both, not just one. This would not impact the individual market.
Questions? Okay, Representative Mona Sanderson.
Yes, I just want to make sure I understand this. you have a client who needs, who wants insurance, but doesn't want to pay the extra $17 or whatever it is for the dental, and so we are going to they will still pay a minimum of their group insurance, and we're subsidizing.
No, Ms. Chair, Representative Anderson, the $17 was the employee's share. We probably, I mean, the employee's pretty much taken care of. It's generally in the dependents and the children that is the real issue for us. Or, because almost in every case, an employer pays anywhere from 75% to 100% of the premium for the employee. It's not the employee really that creates the problem. It's when you have a spouse and children that want to enroll in that group benefit plan, which includes both medical and dental, they're required to take both. And that's where it really impacts it.
So they have, the group requires them to have both dental and medical. And this bill then will allow explain it again.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this bill would allow us to subsidize the purchase of that dental as a part of that group health benefit plan.
Because that is required.
Whether it would be 50% subsidy for the dental or 70, depending again on their income level.
And then not all groups require that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, not all groups either require that you take both, and many groups don't even have dental as an option. But in those cases where dental is required and is a part of that package, we want to be able to make sure that the families can still access that coverage.
Rocky, in a nutshell, this is designed to help Fiat match the market. So, any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Did you want me to summarize the amendment now, or did you want me to come back? You don't.
Go ahead. I mean, we don't have it, but go ahead and tell me what it is we're doing.
Ms. Chair and members of the committee, there is a proposed amendment that will be coming to you, and it really has two components. The first is really to modify what we did in 2159, which is to say not that we shall use or may use a TPA, but it says we may use more than one TPA. And the reason for that is we kind of got into a position that maybe we want to take premium billing, maybe we want to take eligibility, and like DHS does, have a variety of TPAs involved in the administration of the program rather than a single. And that may make sense because there may be pieces of our program as we expand that we may want to outsource because it makes sense economically, but we just don't want to outsource the whole thing because that doesn't make sense economically. So that's the first proposed amendment, just to say TPAs with apostrophe S rather than third-party administrator without the apostrophe. The second, though, is a little bit more substantive, and I talked about it a little bit before the audit committee, and that's under the federal waivers. They require that we reimburse providers for certain health care benefits, primarily immunizations and well baby care, when they are not a part of the health care plan. And as you may not know, but immunizations and well baby and well child care aren't necessarily mandated by or not mandated by state statutes to be included in plans, where the majority of them do provide immunizations, well child, well baby care. There are a number of group and individual plans that do not, especially immunizations, for example, for children from 7 to 18. They'll usually do the children below 6, but they may not above 7 to 18. We have implemented the waiver and are trying to do what we call a referral system. Somebody calls up, we've notified all the clients, is if you don't provide, if your health plan doesn't provide immunizations, call us. We'll try to hook you up. But there are parts of the state where going to a local health clinic, especially the rural parts, it makes a lot more sense to us to say, go to your wherever it is, your doctor, and get it, and we'll reimburse you for the cost of that. So this just gives us authority to reimburse providers for certain benefits required by the federal government that are not or may not be included in a particular health care plan. There is a fiscal impact for that, and I believe it will be given to you with the amendment. I think it was approximately 128 lives. So out of the 15,000, there's approximately $400,000 between the group dental and the immunization would have a reduction of about 122 lives in the people we serve. We're not asking for more money. We live within whatever dollars are appropriated. It just would be a reduction in the people served.
Questions? Thank you, Rob. Jane?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jane Myers representing the Oregon Dental Association. This is a pretty short piece of testimony in support of House Bill 2160. However, I will say we don't know anything about the amendments, but conceptually we do support 2160 because it would provide access to more low-income people for dental care and therefore increase their dental health. Thank you.
Questions? I didn't expect any, Jane, because if you don't understand that sentence, you shouldn't be sitting up here. Thank you very much. Committee, we will wait till we have the amendments before we move the bill. I think that's appropriate. And we will also, we'll probably schedule this one for the next hearing when we have Rocky's other bill, which I think it was referred from audit to here, I believe it was. I only know of one bill that showed up in audit, and they immediately sent it to us, so I'm assuming that's the one. So we should have it or get it or whatever. So it's in the pipeline. Okay. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2160, and we are adjourned. This makes up for Monday. Okay. I'm going for an average.